the caravan monk Ajahn Chah, who kind of, and they were describing that one of the things they would meditate on was space. You know, they just watch Star Trek for hours. No. No, just kind of being aware of space. And as kind of an object of meditation. And I was kind of thinking of that as kind of a interesting way of looking at what you're doing, because what we usually notice is we're always concentrating on things, not on the space. And actually, when you get caught up in something, what you're really getting caught up is really, there's even that kind of all those expressions like narrow-mindedness or spacious mind, spacious heart. And part of it is not restricting your view. You know, you notice space only when you kind of withdraw your attention a little bit from being so fixated on the object. Think of when you kind of get caught up in something, the way all you're noticing is whatever you're, what's there. To see the space, you have to actually withdraw some of the attention from what you're looking at, what you're experiencing, and noticing the openness around it. You know, like space is peaceful. You know, it's hard to kind of say, wow, this is upsetting space. Unless it's my space. Or your space, but you know what I mean? Like space itself is, you know, that's about as neutral as you can get, is space. It's the objects, the things that we see in it that are attractive, repellent, that we're either grasping or pushing away. And actually being aware of the space kind of allows you to have a better perspective on what's there. And all you have to do is think of your meditation. When there's a quality of space around what's appearing and disappearing, you're not so caught up in it. When you're caught up in it, it's kind of like there's no space around it. Everything is restricted. The same thing in your life. When you experience something as being very binding and restricting, you're not noticing the real nature of what's going on, the way it begins and ends, and all the space that's there. You know, because space itself is not bounded by anything. You know, it's the nature of it is that it's unbounded. In fact, I remember dredging up some of my undergraduate philosophy. There was a famous principle in philosophy that Immanuel Kant came up with, is that you can't think without space and time. It's an obvious point, but what the heck, he's the first one to kind of make that a principle of philosophy, that you can't, thought is impossible without a spatial element and a temporal element. You know, you can't think of something without time. It's impossible to even think what that would be. Your mind can't structure the timeless. Nor can the mind structure without space. And actually, space and the objects in them are kind of another form of, from the scripture of great wisdom, a form is empty. Empty is form, which is another common translation of that line, that you see the objects only because there's emptiness, space around them. You know, you have to have the space to see the objects. You also need the objects to see the space. You can't see just space any more than you can just see time without something moving through time. You know, there's no, and it's even why in throwing more, hopefully not indigestible, intellectual gobbledygook into this, it's kind of like in modern physics, they say space and time only exist in relation to things. There's no theoretical space and time. You know, they actually only exist in terms of form and things. You know, in fact, you know, they'll talk about the universe being bounded or expanding, but they say there's no such thing as a universe without something in it. You know, there's no theoretical point of space and time outside a universe. You know, they only all exist together. Now, I'm trying to remember what I'm saying, why I'm saying this. Why am I throwing all this stuff? Yeah, why the hell is the point of all this? Anyway, can somebody say something? Maybe I'll remember why I just told you all this.
Are they mutually space and time exist because of things, and things exist because of space and time?
Yeah, but that's physics. That actually, it's the in terms of like theory of relativity, there's actually four dimensions, and the three are the spatial dimensions, and the fourth is time, and they're all needed for reality. Our universe is structured, and like objects actually distort space time because they only resist. There's no theoretical space and time, they exist in terms of the things that are in it. So when, and actually you kind of can't picture one without the other. So it's, which is just a little jump, is you can't put yourself outside space and time. You can't find a point in the universe where you're not being bound by the universe. Kind of like, and in terms of science, what that means is that you can't get outside of gravity. Which is the form always has a gravitational element. There's no such thing as as a place to be outside of gravity. And that would be kind of coming up with something to say, you exist, but you don't exist, because even one object has gravity. So you kind of, and then that's the object itself, if it's the only object, becomes the whole universe. Yeah?
When you're talking about the space between objects and, there's a drawing technique that's really useful that our mind, when we know what the beginning of an object is and we're trying to draw it, the mind says, well, a nose looks like this. And what children, when they try to draw a nose and it's turning sideways, they still draw it from the front view because you have this idea in your mind that these objects look like this. But when they draw the spaces, when you look at something and you really see it, and you look at the space, the spaces between the objects, you can draw them really accurately if you're trying to draw the space between them rather than the object itself, which makes drawing on the presentation easier.
Yeah, it makes the point, in that it's space. Anyway, coming back, I guess what I was saying more or less is that space and time, our basic structure of our reality, you can't, and that meditation, in a way, you kind of can't put yourself outside of it, but being aware of the openness of space and time, particularly of space, really, in this lecture rather than time, is what I was talking about, kind of does, it's almost like thinking, a room has furniture, it's full of things. You build a house here, you have a room here, you take everything out, the space isn't affected by it. The building disappears. The space is still completely unaffected. Everything can come in and out. And the space itself is not being affected by all the movement. And in a way, we want our hearts and mind to be that way. That because it's the clinging that makes us not to feel like we have to protect our, all those kind of, coming up with too many of them, but all those kind of expressions like, where you have to protect your space. Protect yourself. And it's why, kind of a spacious mind has room for everything, while a narrow mind is restricted. It has little space, so it must kind of manipulate and control reality and push away much of life because it can't control it. And that's that feeling of restriction you have when you're in a situation and you feel so bound by it, so controlled by it. Think of it, you just open up the space and actually open up the time too and see that things coming in, coming out. And what's really being affected by the fact that this person is annoying or that your back hurts right now or whatever's going on. And in a way, we're longing. One way of seeing, the Buddha said, there is, oh monks, there is an unborn, undying, unchanging, uncreated. If there was not, there would not be a refuge from that which is being born, dying, created. We all have a longing for that sense of the unbounded. The universe is as the boundless sky. and which is just to be open and not restricted. And, you know, our longing for the Buddha in a way is a longing for that which isn't being bound in our lives. You know, and just like walls only artificially bound space, space itself is always unbounded, just an artificial construct. The same way as all the things that are binding our lives are artificial constructs. You know, when you think about it, we generate it all. I mean, when somebody's bothering us, they're not doing anything. We're being bothered by me, by what we're doing with it. Somebody else can be in the same situation, be completely, and we've all been in that situation where it's kind of, and there's a liberating quality when we both can help others and others can help us. When you're in a situation and you're kind of feeling, God, no. And the other person just says, okay. You know, and you're both in the same situation. You know, because it's not the situation that's binding us. And actually, the way we get caught up in our you know, just like it's a way of reversing things to think, you know, it's not space in a room. The room's in space, you know, in the midst of the boundless, the building, the world, everything. There's nothing really binding it. You know, everything has an unlimited quality to it when we just let go. Just like you think of what you get caught up in. You know, you sit there in meditation and you're just mesmerized by some aspect of what's going on. Nothing in space kind of grabs your attention. You know, it's kind of like, wow, I'm mesmerized by nothing. You know, wow. You know, it's actually the way the form comes, but you know, the space has, yet actually, if you're, yet when you look at it from the wrong end, it's even more of a message, it didn't translate form is empty and empty is form, is this sounds like, God, who wants space? You know, why would I want to pay attention to nothing? You know, why would I want to pay attention to emptiness? Because that's really what I'm talking about. Yet that emptiness points us to the boundless, points us to the unlimited quality of our hearts and mind, and actually is what allows our heart, you know, actually when you open all the forms in, when you're not grasping them, all the forms come in and find their real relation and their real connection to you. You see, it's just like somebody was describing meditation as, it's like taking a snapshot that doesn't pay any more attention to one thing in the picture than another. It's just neutrally seeing things. Well, that sounds cold. You know, you would say, God, I don't want to just neutrally experience life. But actually, you don't really, because you then allow all the emotions, and all are also part of that neutral thing. And actually, the love and compassion and the connection and the meaning of all of that also appears that way, which we lose when we get mesmerized by one aspect of reality and cling to it and don't notice the openness around it. Just like when we're in a situation that feels closed, we're not noticing the openness around the situation. We're just focusing on how it feels right now. You know, rather than seeing pain as arising and passing, we see it as arising and staying. And then the only thing that matters is right now, and I've been in this position, right now my back hurts, and I don't want it. How long do I have to put up with this? And then life is very restricting when you kind of start viewing it that way. You know, that's just like form is empty, empty is form. Form and space get their meaning from each other. You don't have one without the other. You know, there's no emptiness without form. You know, you can't experience the Buddha by stepping outside the world. You know, by stepping outside of the forms, because that's the only way you can see what's there, you know, is through the vehicle of the forms. But to see the forms, you also have to see the space around it.
I read somewhere, I don't remember where, but a Zen master said something like, speaking of time, that he was referring to theoretical time phases. What do you think you might have meant by that?
Nothing is really being moved. Time and space. Time is the experience of the movement. What is fundamentally real isn't moving. So in the end, that's why you can use the word like eternal, unborn, all these images, because really, from a Buddhist point of view, what's moving through time is karma. You know, it's the, you know, all of what you think of as movement, you can see that there's karma. You know, something's coming, something's going, something's created, something's destroyed, some feeling, some event, and those are all karmic, you know, causes and effects. And in a way, it's karma moving through time. And there's something much deeper, you know, that isn't being bound by time. You know, and that's like if you read Uji, that's in a way what Uji is talking about, and Reverend Master did lectures on that, you know, where she kind of substituted, actually for time, she substituted the eternal. No, actually, it was existence, time, flow. She substituted the Buddha for the flow. And it's all ways of saying that there's something within the change, there's something that's not changing. And time and, you know, nothing's really being bound and nothing's fundamentally changing. And when we're trying to find that still place when we're meditating, where by letting go of the change, we can see that in the end, it's almost like a dream unfolding. Nothing's really being moved. Yeah. In the Den Koroku, that's why the Den Koroku is translated, you know, in all the tenses, because nothing, you know, it's the same sound, you know. What is real is always there and isn't being moved. And that's actually that's the place that's unbounded that we're looking for. And that allows us to be just like the lotus. The universe is as a boundless sky. As lotus blossoms not wetted by the water that surrounds it. Pure and beyond the world is the mind of the trainee. O holy Buddha, we take refuge in thee. The universe is boundless. Yet still, it's like a lotus growing up that's not being bound by the forms around it. It isn't being bound by the time and the space. Yet it's still rooted in the earth. It's still experiencing the time and space and not being bounded. You can't jump, and it's just like another image they use in Buddhism is the great round mirror. You know, you've probably all heard the expression, the great round mirror, you know, the mirror of meditation. I'm losing stride. Why did I just say that? The great round mirror. And you can't jump out of the great round mirror. You kind of can't find a place that's not reflecting space and time, change. And there's no point to it. It's to see that within the context of the space, you know, nothing's really, it's like the space in the room, nothing's really being moved. We think this is all importance, but the space is unaffected by it. And the space is not so cold and empty. The space is the realm of the Buddhas. You know, it's the life of the Buddha. And, you know, it's just like our real heart isn't affected by it. And nothing can affect it. It's why nothing in karma, nothing karmically in the end changes what is real. It's just creating another wave that has to, in the end, just return again to its nature as still water. In the end, you can't keep generating waves endlessly. the real nature of water, you know, is water. The wave is just something on top of it.
The karma is just a little ripple on
it. Yeah. And it's why if you sink below, the water's always still. I'm mixing too many metaphors here, but that's okay. What the heck? I'll throw them all into one class and kind of make everyone's head hurt. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, that's a hard... Well, actually, I'll try to... It's harder to meditate on. The other image I was going to bring into this is that kind of fits in with space is silence. Sound and silence. Again, it's almost the same duality. Silence actually only exists in terms of sound. You know, if you don't have any sound, there's no... It's kind of a meaningless concept, silence. It's... And... The silence of your mind is like space. It's always there, but it's only there when you're not getting caught up in all the noise. And you hear the silence, which is very rarely an absolute silence, because if you're silent, it's almost like you silence your mind. Suddenly you hear the silence surrounding the sounds around you. You can even have that space around your thoughts. Because there's silence actually around our thoughts when we get quiet enough to notice that we don't have to be, you know, chattering non-stop. And we want to hear that silence around so there's peace rather than just a non-stop drone in our heads. And, you know, and silence has no extreme quality. You know, so you have to be quiet and still to notice it. You know, you kind of can't, you know, you kind of can't want silence to drown out everything else. And we have to kind of silence our thoughts just to hear the silence that enfolds us. And actually, if you think about it, we've all experienced this in meditation. This is one of the most common basic aspects of meditation, is that silence. You know, when we stop thinking, there's silence. And in fact, in being aware of silence, the mind is kind of concentrated in a state of balance and openness rather than just being absorbed in some object, some thought. You know, and you have to kind of just let go and be still. Kind of can't concentrate really hard on silence. Okay. You know, or actually what happens then, every noise then becomes really irritating. In fact, sometimes when I tell people about meditation, one of my standard instructions is the fact that if you concentrate really hard on silence, every noise bothers you. Just like if you concentrate on the wall, suddenly the wall starts doing weird things if you stare at the wall too hard. You have to kind of let go and just let it be. Let the sounds just be. You know, just, you're back at work, let there be silence in your... You know, don't fill everything up. Don't compulsively think you need to keep doing. Pause. Take a breath. You know, the wall of silence, the space is all there. Nothing's really binding you. Remember, it's your mind binding you. You know, sometimes people, I have to get all this done. Well, that's what you're doing to yourself. All you can do is what you're doing. You don't need to have this whole long list of things you have to get done and keep telling it to yourself and driving yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
always come. Even when the cars on the hand have a left, there are stops for us to tell you.
Well, there's that kind of a neurological sound that are in the silence. You know, there's kind of a little, but you know, there's a slight neurological sound when you get quiet enough that where our systems is generating. So there actually never is absolute silence. But in the end, the noises don't really affect the silence. When you let go of your thoughts, even if there's whatever noises, it doesn't have to. When you're not grasping it, it's just sounds floating by. And there's other times where you realize a classic case is the tick-tock of a clock. You're trying to sleep, and your mind starts fixating on a noise that can actually drive you. You know, in fact, I can still remember, like at the Abbey once, I was up all night, and they just had me sleeping in an office during the day, during the morning. And somebody gave me this alarm clock so I could wake up. But the alarm clock had this incredibly loud tick-tock. It was this giant old kind of massive kind of old wind-up clock. And I remember I just kind of finally just stuck it in a file drawer after about a little while. It was driving me crazy. I'm exhausted. It's like 3 in the morning. Stick it in this, just shove it away. And then slept and forgot completely about it. You know, a few days later somebody said, whatever happened to that clock? But, you know, it's really the openness of hearing the silence around. Different sounds are there. So you don't have to worry about the fact that there is not completely quiet, because it really isn't. You know, there isn't. If you listen hard enough, there's always sounds, both internal sounds and external sounds. You know, absolute silence. You know, you don't have to get into a samadhi tank. You all remember, some of you, samadhi tanks. You know, it was the whole idea, the very way you go into this kind of soundless, dark, soundless body temperature water. Have you heard this? Okay, it was a 60s thing. It was they were literally called samadhi tanks. And what you did is you would kind of immerse yourself in body temperature water without sound or sight, so that you have no sensory input, as minimal as you can. And the whole idea was that it would bring you to a deeper state of consciousness. Samadhi tanks. Obviously, they're not that big anymore because, you know, they really... But next time we do a retreat, we can just all get it. <You know? laughs> You know, go to our samadhi tanks and... Yeah, that's just a way to kind of... And then, of course, you know, you think, what do you do when you hit back reality with all of its noise and sound? In fact, the most common experience people will have after their first retreat at the Abbey is they'll leave the Abbey and just be sort of overwhelmed when they walk into a drugstore, you know, walk into Thrifty. First you bow. And all of you probably think, after you've went to retreats a while, that completely went away. You know, but your first retreat, almost everybody walks out and is bowing, and suddenly there's Muzak there. What is all this stuff? Completely deluded or not?
Totally off. Now, but just not trying to do anything in particular, except sort of being aware. I mean, having drawn things and be aware of the volume of space in the room, the volume of space that's defined by the walls and the various things in it. And that is the stillness, and then within that are various things, but it gives you this real sense. I'm pretty visually oriented, that's sort of the way I...
Yeah, that sounds good, as long as you're not... Yeah, to be aware of space without objects, almost you have to, you know, kind of keeps you at peace, just like being aware of silence with the thoughts kind of keeps you from your it by nature, you're not grasping the thoughts, and so it's just different ways to kind of structure the mind to let go and be still. And that's actually why I was talking about space, because doing something like that is fine. We're trying, you know, just like instead of concentrating on thoughts, being aware of the open space around the thoughts, the silence and space around our obsessions and fears. The nature of it is, if you can see the space around the fear, the arising and the passing of the fear, is actually to see the unreality of the fear. Because you can see nothing's really being affected by the fear. It's just something that's being reflected on the mirror briefly. While the usual way we do is we grasp it, and it's the reality is the fear. The reality is the upset. I was just thinking of, remember not long ago talking to somebody, a monk who was having great difficulty, and it was almost like he couldn't see around what he was going through. You know, it was like he felt so blocked. And there was space and openness around it. Nothing really was wrong. But he was making it such a hard barrier. You know, when there was nothing there, and you could really sense that, you know, the person was doing fine, there's nothing there. All he has to do is just relax. You know, and it'll, you know, there wasn't even a problem. But, you know, there was such a hardness there, and not just such a setup that kind of created a wall. And it's almost like a wall of not seeing the flow of his life. You know, that old 60s, as I guess, of samadhi tax, you know, be in the flow, you know, get with the flow. All those kind of 60s expressions that I was nurtured on. And mostly actually found, okay, after a while, they're a little, you know, something isn't right here, you know. But, you know.
Well, but also you can more or less simultaneously be aware of it. And this is what I found helpful, is that there are various objects within the volume of space that arise and pass, kind of like bubbles in a glass of champagne. You know, there's this volume of empty space, and these bubbles arise and dissipate in different places in the room or in the volume of space. And so you have less attachment to them. You can see that, yes, for instance, an object of, say, of anger comes up over here. You can say, yes, this is something that comes up for me periodically, but you can also see that there's something else over here, and it's just one thing. So you can be more detached from that.
Yeah, that sounds good. I like, you know, that's a good, that sounds like a helpful approach to it. And I think, you know, we'll all have our own way of making sense out of, you know, these kind of theoretical, you know, because, you know, visual, you know, just people will describe what they do, and it's, you know, all slightly different, because some of us see things visually, some of us see things, you know, in all different ways. But in a way, a lot of meditation is that we're not battling evil, we're not battling desire, we're not struggling for the good. We're letting things go and seeing everything arising and passing in our boundless mind, boundless heart, that in the end all this stuff doesn't fundamentally matter. You know, there's nothing we need to cling to. Grasping happiness or fearing or fleeing evil is all dukkha. It's all a form of suffering. You know, nothing's really being affected by it. That's why, like, patience and acceptance are both expressions of the Buddha. They point us to the unbounded. You know, by not being moved, patience and acceptance is allowing that stuff and saying it's just stuff on the mirror. You know, we don't have to kind of get, there's nothing wrong, no big deal. It's just like, oh, it's like a scene in a, you know, sometimes I watch movies and they'll have some violent scene. So now all I do is I just, you know, traditionally, I just don't watch, you know, I don't have to kind of get upset, oh, there's some horrific violence in a movie. I just don't watch it, you know, and you just, it doesn't really matter. It's just an image in a movie. And actually, if I had to watch it, it'd be okay, because it's just an image in a movie. But on the other hand, there's no real reason to watch it, and there's no big deal.
thinking about the hardness, I like that term concretized, or concrete box.
Yeah.
Where instead of letting something flow, it becomes becomes concrete.
Oh, yeah.
Really heavy and strong.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, just like when people often describe what they think of themselves. They have this concrete image. You know, God, this isn't me. You know, just think of that when you kind of say that. This isn't me, or this is me. You know, that's why one of the things you're doing in practice is, it's always like, I always like the fact that when you do meditate on koans, one of the ways they often had you first meditate was on the kind of the koan of, who is it that's breathing in and out? You know, who are you? Because that's so much the delusion that there's no space around. You know, just like it's easy to talk about space, but when you're suffering, there's no space. How do you find the space? And part of it is really to stop projecting the future and the past. In the moment, the space is there. Even in the midst of pain, there's actually space and openness around it. You're not really being bound by the pain. The thing that binds you is never the pain. It's projecting the pain into the future. And projecting a you that can't put up with the pain in the future. And you really don't know what it means and what... You don't have to determine that. You know, we're always projecting ourselves as we are now in the future. You know, and that's often depressing. You know, you kind of think, God, I put up with it this long. I don't want to have to keep putting up with me. And of course, you're just, in a way, projecting a delusion, because there isn't a fixed self there. You never know what will wash away, you know, what will actually just disappear in the mirror and not really matter. You know, what will dissolve from concrete, you know, into... and just become compost. You know what? Yes, well, that's one of those images of training I always like, that our whole lives are compost. It all can break down, and actually, and it does, you know, it all feeds the lotus. All our suffering is actually the stuff that's feeding our lotus, you know, that's growing it. You know, if we allow it just to break down, you know, it's, in fact, it creates a fire in us to train. Because the more that we're aware of how bounded we are, the more that there's a longing to be free. And we all have a longing, a deep, deep longing for that spacious heart and mind. A deep longing not to feel, you know, to feel the boundless. A deep longing not to feel this restriction and just to be open and be able to kind of be embrace things. It's actually why we often don't have empathy and compassion for others, because we're so bound by our karma that we actually can't even pay attention to anything else. The less you are, the more, you know, it's why love and compassion are not something we have to generate. You know, they're just an expression of the boundless that embraces everything. You know, just like when you look at suffering and stillness, it doesn't matter if it's your suffering or somebody else's suffering. You really would like to help with it. You know, it's, you know, there's no reason you want to see beings suffer. Else left in my notes.
Breathing backwards, even towards the eyes.
Yeah, that's a good. Why don't you explain more why you find that helpful?
Not breathing, you can be anxious and tight, focused, and open up an inhale, it gives you space.
Did you say breathless breathing?
Yeah, inhale on the tip of the spine, and as you breathe in, you feel the firmness of the back. And as you exhale, it settles down.
It's even why when you're not, one thing that tells you about something is how you're breathing, because your breathing reflects. You know, if your breathing is tight, restricted, and all the rest, you know, it's a way, it's like I always like, there's a Buddhist teaching that you hold all your emotions. Your head holds your thoughts, so when you get caught up in your thoughts, your head hurts. When you get caught up in your feelings, your chest hurts, and you can't breathe. And all you have to do is think, when you're overwhelmed by rough things, how, you know, the breath gets shallow, restricted, and you can even have pain across. And when you open up, when you open your mind and you open your heart, then, you know, the breath rises up the back, goes down the front, which is the turning of the wheel, and in your hara, your heart, you know, your guts, there's peace. And there's the, and, you know, that's the natural circulation of the meditation. And that when we're at peace and open, that's what happens in our body and mind. And to let that happen actually does, you know, is to allow, you're letting space and silence in there, because when you hold on to things, it won't be there. And you're trying to open things up. And an image I always like of the circulation of the breath is, there's one image I always kind of liked is, you know, one monk I remember telling me, he said, every time you inhale, you're asking the Lord for help. And as you exhale, the help is being given. Of course, you're kind of, the rising up the spine is yourself realizing and opening yourself and asking for the help. And then the response flows through you and settles in your heart. And each time you kind of ask for help, the help is actually being given. It's just you have to be open to the help. That's why every request for help is answered. Because every time the Lord is flowing through us, it's just a question of us being open to experience it. You know, it's always happening. The wheel's always turning in us to some level or other. It's just, if we're completely blocked, we can't experience it. You know, if you're caught up in your head, nothing gets past it. If you get caught up in your feeling, nothing gets past it. It's kind of like a dam. And it's even causing the pain in a lot of the disharmony of, that's why Dogen, you know, has the line, you know, that training, Buddhist training, is just harmonizing body and mind. You know, just bringing our bodies and minds in harmony with the truth, which is really just not something you do physically, something you do by letting go and being at peace. Then your body's naturally in harmony, and your mind's in harmony, and your heart's in harmony. And we have to deal with all those blocks that are stopping us from being in harmony. And when you're getting headaches, you know something's being blocked. And when you're, you know, in different parts just don't work, if you really concentrate, you can kind of probably see what you're, look at what you're holding on to and let go. Nothing is really, you know, you really don't want to be holding on to it. That's what makes training easy on one level. In the end, we don't want to be doing it anyway. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, hitting yourself on the head with a hammer. You really don't want to be doing it. You know, you don't have to kind of think, God, how can I stop this? You know, really don't want to be, you know, doing it. You know, we want to be at peace.
I once described when you go to Sanzen, they suggested that rather than going with the thought of what is wrong with me, to think instead what is true for me today. And to, you know, when you look at that, it gives you more space rather than kind of saying,
you know, getting kind of huddled in within yourself and kind of focusing on what we think is our problem. I just wanted to ask, you know, when you're talking about the suffering and how you feel that, and
yourself when you're with people, particularly as opposed to ones that are in your family or people who you know really well, where their suffering is so close. And people are not in any meditation practice. Does the breathing when you're sitting with them help them actively, or is it the merit of your own training that you can help best with?
Well, I mean, both help. I mean, in the end, you can't get caught up with what you're, you know, where the help comes from. In a way, you have to let go and remember what really helps beings isn't us. We just get out of the way, the Lord helps all, the help is there, and, you know, you kind of can't get, you know, all you can do is not allow that, you have to regard their suffering like you regard your suffering, you know, there's nothing to cling to, you have to kind of have compassion for it. Naturally want to help it if there's a way to help it, but just be still and realize nothing is fundamentally being affected by it, so you can be at peace, you know. And sometimes if this suffering is very intense in somebody else, just like if it's very intense in us, that's a point where we probably have to try to deepen our meditation so we don't get pulled off center by the suffering of others, and just express the compassion and whatever we can do. But in the end, the real cleaning, both of our hearts and other hearts, isn't being done by us. We just get out of the way. You know, when the Buddha does all, you know, that's enlightenment. So all we have to do is, you know, if there's something we can do, do it. You know, I mean, if somebody is suffering and that, you know, and there's a way you can help them and it's good to do, do it. Sometimes sympathetic listening, or sometimes our faith, just like I was talking about before, not being moved by the suffering yourself and expressing the feeling like it's still okay who you are is a help. You know, there's nothing really wrong there. All they have to do, the real help they need to do, is to let go. And sometimes the suffering's going to have to get worse before they let, you know, they'll have to hit bottom to let go. Sometimes it won't happen in this lifetime, and that's fine. But in a way, the image I always liked, that I always found helpful, is of how to deal with suffering. It's that image I always like use it talking about when a Zen monk was taken visiting the country, and he was taken to a slaughterhouse back 70, 80 years ago when the first Zen masters in the country. For some reason they took him to a slaughterhouse, and he went in the slaughterhouse and passed out. You know, just completely overwhelmed by the horror of what was going on then. And the monk who was Nyogen Senzaki, who actually was the first Zen monk to live in this country, when he heard about it, he says, there are places monks should not go unless they have to. If they do go there, they should be, make sure they look very deeply so they're not overwhelmed by the appearances. You know, so that's why people, you know, can be in a concentration camp and can be in hell, can be surrounded by utter suffering and still describe it as a place of great peace and joy, because nothing is really still being lost despite the sea of suffering. And sometimes when you look at the world, it's just a sea, you know, the perception just becomes, it's like suffering everywhere. And if you're not careful, you'll get caught, in a way, you'll get caught up in it, and that's reality to you. When it's just something reflecting off the mirror, that's, you know, causes great sorrow, and it's going to be painful because that's the nature of it. There'd be something wrong with you. In fact, none of us would want to be that person who sees suffering, a great suffering, and doesn't feel awful, because that would be pretty awful. You know, it'd be like somebody who's You know, just like the other day, God, I had, it was such a dramatic case, but this woman came by, she just came by once. This was that French woman, remember, Misha? And she kind of came back a second time, and she's actually a Christian, and she kind of said, looked at our board and said, can you put up a transfer of merit? And I say, oh, sure, you know, a note for me. And I say, sure. And she said, oh, it's for my son who died. And I go, looking at this woman who's relatively young, I'm thinking, okay, what happened? The woman's, you know, oh, sure, but can you, we usually put some details. So she said, well, he was 8 months. And I go, okay, when did he die? 2 months ago. How did he die? And she said, well, I fell. He was in my backpack. I fell. Had a very bad fall and he died. And I thought, oh my God, you know, it's like, it takes your breath away. You know, and you know, you just feel, God, you know, because you know that has to be, you know, you're just aware, God, to have an accident that killed your infant is so painful. And it would actually be pretty bad if I didn't feel awful. You know, when somebody, you know, you would just, you know, kind of be, you know, you don't want to be insensitive. You know, that would be actually deluded to hear suffering and not to feel like, my God, you know, and just have the desire, okay, I'll offer all the merit you can to this poor woman who needs the merit, I think, a lot more than her infant son who... You know, because, you know, it must be an incredible load to have that.
One thing going to what Misha was saying that I've become aware of is that I noticed that there's a sympathetic sort of resonance when you encounter suffering from other people, like, for instance, anger. Did I find myself getting angry? And there have been times where why am I getting angry with this person? Maybe it's somebody at work who's raging about something, and I find myself getting angry, and then I realize that there's a sympathetic response to their anger, and you have to be really careful not to kind of fall into that and accept that as what's going on, but recognize that it is there.
Oh, yeah.
And the same thing with depression or sorrow.
Yeah. And the reverse, it's even why it's good to train with the Sangha, because, you know, you have a sympathetic, think about it, it's the same principle with somebody else's faith. If you, you know, if you follow, just like you pick up on somebody else's anger, you're around somebody who is exhibiting positive qualities, you pick up on that too. And there's a sympathetic response, wow. And that's why, in a way, you know, they say in Buddhism, avoid those who are ignorant, you know, those who are deeply deluded, because in the end, you will have, you know, you aren't separate from them. Their suffering affects you, you know, you're going to feel it. Their anger is going to affect you. Their doubt's going to affect you. You know, you get to a group of people who just say, why the hell are you doing this? You get enough of that, you know, you kind of think, why am I doing this? You know, it's like, you know, I remember somebody saying, you mean you're really spending all that time just looking at a wall?
Did you put some advertising?
You know.
That's why I like my off-repeat story. My brother said when I told him that I did this, he said, well, wouldn't it be better if you had TVs in the wall?
We do.
Yes. And I have more than 120 channels. Yeah. Yeah. And it is weird sitting there watching a music video. Yeah.